Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. If you love good narrative nonfiction about true stories, here's a great book for you. Buddy Levy's Empire of Ice and Stone. It recounts the true story of the ill-fated 1913 Canadian Arctic expedition and the two men who came to define it. Now, a lot's been written about this expedition over the years, but Buddy Levy's research includes little-known facts and some really delicious details that bring this harrowing journey and its characters to life. Buddy Levy is the author of 8 books. His award-winning work has been featured or reviewed in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, NPR, USA Today, the Washington Post, and the list goes on. It's very long. He was the co-star for 25 episodes on History Channel's docuseries Decoded with Brad Meltzer, who, by the way, joins us next month. And Buddy Levy was featured as an on-camera expert in Leonardo DiCaprio's TV series, The Frontiersmen, The Men Who Built America. So again, we're talking today about Buddy Levy's latest book, Empire of Ice and Stone, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Kaluk. Here's my guest, Buddy Levy. Buddy Levy, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Vicki, thanks so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. I love your book. First work of yours that I've read, and I'm looking forward to reading more now. But you have such an interesting background, Buddy. You've worked in TV. You spent 7 years writing about adventure racing, a featured expert in Leonardo DiCaprio's Frontiersmen, a co-star with Brad Meltzer, who we've had on the show several times in Decoded. But I heard that your writing journey began when you entered a competition as a teenager. So let's tell us about that and how that got you into writing.
Oh, thanks. What an awesome blast from the past. Well, actually, what happened was that my I went to a private school in a little ski town called Sun Valley, Idaho, and it was a very small school. I think that the first year of it, we had only about classmates of six people per classroom, you know. And it was kind of an informal competition to do some creative writing, and my instructor, the headmaster's spouse, Julie Hazard, and one of the teachers really liked this story I had written, which was about, it was a hunting story, and in fact, a bunch of hunting happens in Empire of Ice and Stone, but she really liked the story, and it turned out there was a relatively well-known woman named Clara Spiegel, who lived in our town, and we used to go on expeditions and safaris with Ernest Hemingway, who also spent a great deal of time in Sun Valley, Idaho. And short version is that she said, you know, you should probably work with Clara Spiegel and Clara had written novels and was an editor. And so Clara Spiegel took me under her wing and helped work on this story and with her tutelage. I was 14 at the time, and it ended up getting published in the local newspaper and serialized in 2 installments. And at that time, I really just, you know, I loved the process, and I also loved seeing my byline and my name above a story. And then I went on to study English and literature and continue my writing to this day.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating story. It's always interesting to learn where people started and how one thing leads to another. And often it's just a case of not saying no, right? It's a case of saying yes to those opportunities.
Oh, so, by the way, my whole life is a case of not saying no.
Yeah, I kind of gathered that when I was doing some research on your background. So let's talk about the Empire of Ice and Stone, your new book, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Kaluk. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
So I love that the book here starts with a newspaper story in Seattle, one in Seattle, one in New York. But for listeners, let's just give a synopsis of the story here so that they know what we're talking about. And of course, it's a story about the Canadian Arctic expedition that goes horribly wrong and the struggle for survival in incredibly harsh conditions. So fire away with that, if you would, please.
Well, sure. So the sort of thumbnail sketch and why I started where I did was that there was this Icelandic-American, though he was born in Manitoba, Canadian named Vilhelmur Stefansson. And he was an explorer and a scientist, and he had just returned from 4 years of living among the Inupiat and peoples of, in northern Alaska and northern Canada. And he came off the ship in Seattle in 1912 with the story of having encountered what he was calling blonde Eskimos, and the suggestion was that they were blonde-haired, blue-eyed native peoples that were descendants of the Viking Eric the Red. And, you know, it was interesting because he didn't really come up with the story. He had heard it also, but he had encountered peoples and said, and so the news reports just sort of went with it big time. I mean, there, like you say, there were articles in the Seattle Times and in the New York Times, and he sort of didn't contest anything was wrong with this story or that there was any controversy about it. And he actually used the story. He was a very astute media guy, so he used the story to garner backing for a subsequent expedition, the one the book concerns, and he put that together within less than a year. And so he was sponsored by the American Museum of Natural History and ultimately the Canadian government, and he put together an elaborate three-ship armada to go do science in the North.
And why did you want to write this story? I mean, it's a very well-known story. What was it that drew you to it to make this your next big project? Because it was a big project.
Oh, that's a great question. Well, so I had written a book called Labyrinth of Ice about the Greeley expedition that came out in 2019. And I have to say, part of it has to do with my background. My father was an Olympic Nordic skier, and he was in the 1956 Olympics. And he did a lot of traveling in Scandinavia during his skiing days in the 50s. When we were in Sun Valley, you know, he started telling me all about the Scandinavian explorers and people like Fridtjof Nansen and Roald Amundsen. And he always highlighted how tough and amazing these people were. And so, long story short, I ended up going later, and also he inured me to, or at least got me interested in being really, really cold and what that's like, because he would take me out duck hunting in minus 25 degree weather when I was like 13 and say, you know, this is sort of the conditions that the Arctic explorers had to endure. And so I ended up cast way forward to 2003, and I wrote a I was traveling in Greenland writing about a fellow that you actually have had on your show before, Eric Weinmayer, and he was competing in this competition, and I went there to see what that was all about. And during that time I met a Norwegian woman, and she gave me this book about the first crossing of Greenland. Her name is Ingrid, and she gave me this book, and he was a hero of hers, and she said, you know, check this out. And at that point, I just became absolutely enthralled in Arctic exploration and narratives. And when I was doing the research for Labyrinth of Ice, I came across the story of the Karluk, and it was so compelling, but I had to keep writing on the book that I was working on, so I filed it away, you know. Someday I'm going to come back to this, and I'm sure glad I did, because it was even more dramatic in certain respects than it may be the most dramatic, you know, say other than Shackleton's Endurance, which I think is the Alfred Lansing's Endurance about Shackleton's voyage is probably the, you know, the bar by which all other Arctic narratives and polar narratives are measured, but this one comes pretty close.
Yeah. And one of the things you did exceptionally well is really get into the hearts and the minds of the people on board here. I do remember seeing a documentary on this a while ago, but you really brought this to life, which is important if you want readers to keep turning the page. I wonder if we can just take a quick look at the two lead characters here, because you've got Stephenson, who is kind of fanciful and selfish, and then you've the science from the scientific team. Tell us a little bit about him as a man, as a human being.
Right. So, it became clear to me pretty early on that in addition to it being a remarkable story of survival and courage and heroism and rescue, it was really at the core about these two men. Vilmer Stephenson, the expedition leader whose idea this was, and then the man he chose to captain the flagship, Bob Bartlett, who came from a very famous Newfoundland family in Brigus, the famous Bartletts of Brigus, and they were a generations-old whaler, sealer family. But Stephenson was really fascinating to me because of how he had this chameleon-like quality. So, I mean, he was, from an early age, he just moved from one thing to the next. I mean, he was highly intelligent. He went to the University of North Dakota. He got kicked out of there for... he was gone helping substitute teach while he was supposed to be in class, and he got kicked out. He went to the University of Iowa, finished there within a year, and then he was at Harvard soon. And the next thing you knew, he was off exploring. And so he had this kind of malleability and the ability to kind of form himself into anything he wanted to be or even what people wanted to see in him. He ends up being cast as something of a villain in this book, but it's really because of certain choices that he made during the expedition. I'd say in the totality of his life, I take nothing away from Stephenson's scholarship, his scientific research, but in the year 1913, and in fact, in the first few months of this expedition, the Canadian Arctic Expedition, a number of choices that he makes I find difficult to square with ethically. On the other hand, Bob Bartlett, who inherits the expedition at a certain point when things go really afoul with the ship, he's left to lead, two dozen men and a family of Inupiat people and 32 dogs, and they're stranded on the ice in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. And so he ends up with a fairly large task to try to keep these people alive and then also to ultimately try to effect rescue for them.
Yeah, in reading the story, I mean, Stephenson almost derailed the expedition before it even got off the ground by his demands of the crew that they would he secured all media rights right before he left.
Yeah, so his frenzied activities leading up to this are really remarkable. He has come back from being gone in the Arctic for 4 years, and then he immediately garners backing, goes to Europe and attends a conference where he meets up, a conference on polar exploration, where he meets up with Robert Peary, who recommends Robert Peary, the man who had just claimed the North Pole in 1909, and Peary suggests Bartlett as the captain of the ship. And then so he's got all of these, Stephenson has all of this stuff to do, which is organize scientists and gear, and all the while, he's actually writing a manuscript he's been working on, which deals with the last 4 years, and while everyone's trying to get these ships packed and loaded, he sails under separate ship with a secretary from the American Museum of Natural History, and he's scribbling away on this manuscript so that when he comes back, he's going to potentially have a bestseller on his hand from the previous book. And as you mentioned, at the same time, while he was over in Europe, he met with a number of entities, secured book, newspaper, and film rights, and has also organized a film happening in the spring of 1913 when the ship's supposed to sail, the ship they're supposed to sail basically at early June 1913. So he has his hands full, and yeah, as you mentioned, he basically says that all the diaries and the journals, nobody can publish anything until after a year from the termination of the expedition, and he justifies this by saying that he's not drawing a salary and everyone else is, so mm-hmm. this is going to be the only way he'll be able to profit from it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then on the other hand, you've got Bartlett. And interesting, it was kind of ironic that he gets a telegram about this expedition inviting him, because he always viewed telegrams as harbingers of tragedy, you say in the book. 4 years earlier, he'd come very close to the North Pole, right, within 150 miles, I think it was, and got turned around.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really great sidebar note, and I was fascinated to come across that episode in his life. I didn't really know that, but Bartlett had been hired on after he became a master mariner and had worked in the fishing sealing industries for a number of years. He ends up as Robert Peary's captain and ice navigator for a few of the North Pole attempts, and on the last one, the one in which Peary claims to have made the North Pole, Bartlett is the ice navigator, and when they reach the top of Ellesmere Island and begin on dog sled and foot and snowshoes, Bartlett is chosen as the man to lead what's called the pioneering party, and so they basically broke trail, built igloos, and led out and also navigated. And so when they got to within 150 miles of what it ultimately became the claim to North Pole, Bartlett is asked by Robert Peary to return to the Roosevelt, this amazing iron-hull, 1,000-horsepower ship. And, you know, he's basically 2-3 days from polar immortality. But as a dutiful captain, you know, he does what Peary asks him to do, and then returns to the Roosevelt. Now, that becomes really important because I keep saying claim to the North Pole, but that claim has been contested over the decades. Right. And had Peary brought Bartlett, my supposition is that he would, that might have been less controversial, because Bartlett was expert at taking readings and at navigation and at reading positions, and Peary chose Matthew Henson, who was a better dog sled driver, but not as good taking readings. And so I make the case that this, you know, Bartlett might have solved a lot of problems for Robert Peary had he just brought him along, but that's not how history let it play out.
Right. Well, thank goodness that on the Kahluk they had the indigenous family, because their contribution was really instrumental to saving many lives throughout this journey for them. Let's talk about them a little. Kuraluk, I think, was his name, right?
Right. So, you know, of all the things that Stephenson did wrong in the organization and planning, the one thing that he did right was that when they were heading out in their three-ship armada, they stopped in at near Point Barrow, Alaska, and Stephenson had fully intended all along to hire on some hunters, some Inupiat hunters, and a seamstress, because the use of Arctic garb, fur and skin clothing, was instrumental at that time. You know, it was very important. Mukluks, mittens, parkas, and pants. And so he hired on a man named Kuraluk, a youngish man named Kuraluk, who had a wife named Kuruk, and they end up calling her Auntie. She's a great figure and character in this story. And their two children came as well, and one was a young girl named Helen, and then her little sister named Mukti, who was three. And so they board the Kuraluk in August of 1913, and he also hired on, Stephenson also hired on another young hunter named Tatik Tovik, who becomes very, very important in the story. And so you know, they're brought on because of their diverse skills in sewing Arctic clothing, in building igloos, in hunting seals, hunting other animals that they might encounter, like Arctic foxes, polar bears. Though, funnily enough, in most cases, the polar bears are hunting them in this book, not
yeah.
vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they... this family and Kataktovik, the other young hunter, become really key figures in the survival. And I make the case that, everyone probably would have perished had it not been for this family and Kataktovik, because of their incredible abilities to live in this environment. I'm really glad you brought that up, because they this is a group of people that often get overlooked in tales told in the period in which, you know, sort of the white perspective predominated.
Yeah, but they, as you said, they heavily relied on Koraluk's family and his skills. I mean, even to the kids were helping with skinning the game. So, I mean, everybody got involved there. And Bartlett must have left a real impression with them too, because after the event she named one of her kids Bartlett.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, one of the, I don't want to give too much away, but one of the members ends up having a number of children, one of whom she the littlest person, Mookby, names Bartlett. It's great. It brings things so full circle, you know.
So you did some really intense research for this book, obviously, and thank you for including pictures. I hate when I read these books and there are no pictures, because it's the very first place I go to, so I can picture these people when I'm reading about them.
By the way, you have to be a little careful about going to the pictures first. And in this book, in the front pages, I have a note to for those who don't want spoilers, don't look at the pictures first.
Yeah,
because it sometimes lets you know, like, who survived and who perished, you know.
That's true. I don't mind finding that out, but
for
those who don't want spoilers, don't go to the pictures first. It's just something I always do. So, did you have a favorite character when you were writing this? Did you get a real fondness for one person in particular?
Oh man, that's such a great question, and yeah, I did. But I wanted to add, though, that, you know, and I don't know if you were going to get to it about the the diaries and things.
Yes.
And so my fondness, I suppose, my deepest fondness was for William Laird McKinley, who's hired as a magnetician. He's a Scottish. They call him Wee Mac. He was very small. Like under 5'5", and weighed about 135 pounds, but he was really, really strong and fit. William McKinley, and then there was, and this is stemming back from my upbringing, Nordic skiing and everything, there was a Norwegian character who's hired on as an assistant topographer named Bjarn Mammen, and he is really, I mean, first of all, his diaries are so honest and heartfelt, and you know, there's so many vulnerabilities. You really get to know him as a person, and you know, they're keeping daily diaries over for the period of a year, and every day, with almost without exception, and you're thinking, man, they're writing these things like under the heat of a Primus stove and a candlelight and a dripping igloo, you know, after the end of an 18-hour slog across buckled ice. So Bjarn Mammen becomes really, there's a tenderness to him and also a joy. He's an amazing athlete, and he teaches the other scientists how to ski. He was a champion skier from Norway, and he had brought skis along, and he builds a ski jump, and he's really, he's only 22 when the expedition begins. And then McKinley too is so thoughtful, and he ends up surfacing as a leader in ways that he would have never anticipated, because he ends up with a lot of responsibility, and he'd never been to the Arctic before. And so I really admired someone who is able to adapt at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, his descriptions of the ice and the conditions and of the problems that they're having on the ship and then after
I'm wondering, with all of this research, was there, and you were embedded in this for quite some time, I would imagine, but what surprised you the most, Buddy?
That's a really great question. You know, I think, and this has surprised me every time, I mean, I've been to Greenland, but what surprises me is that the ice is, it becomes, it's like a living, breathing, moving thing. And it, you know, it's not flat. A lot of people sort of just have this image of it being this great expanse that's like a giant wintry ice rink. But it's massive tectonic plates of ice shifting around and being carried by wind and current and crashing into one another. And, you know, so the difficulty of moving across that seascape is amazing, and also that there are up thrusts of up to 100, you know, so where these giant sheets of ice are being driven toward land masses, then they impact with them, and as they make impact, you know, they have, something has to give, and so it sometimes thrusts the ice and crumbles up, and then it freezes there like a giant wave having crashed there, and it's up to 100 feet high. So maybe the character of the ice surprised me the most. And then some aspects of Wrangel Island, too, which is a place above northern Siberia that figures prominently in this story, and just how remarkable a place it really is. And John Muir, the naturalist, had been there in 1881 looking for another shipwreck, and provided incredible descriptions of the place. But I've always been drawn to, you know, really remote, far-flung, harsh environments, and my discoveries about Wrangel Island were really illuminating and beautiful.
Fascinating. Yeah, there's something about the solitude and the wilderness and the wildness that is just mesmerizing, I think. I remember reading that at one point that ship was like drifting about 60 miles a day out to sea. So, I mean, the Mother Nature is just incredible. You can't argue with Mother Nature.
No, and also, you know, one ominous element of that, since you mentioned that, is that so the Jeanette that I mentioned John Muir had been gone looking for, the ship had drifted for over a year, and at one point during the drift of the Karlik, when they're still aboard the ship, and the captain's logs of the Jeanette are on the ship, and they realize that they're moving in almost the precise drift direction, and so everyone is sort of reading this by candlelight at night, thinking, you know, we are destined for an icy, watery grave. And it's quite haunting.
Yeah. Massive story, and of course you can't include every detail, and not every detail is important to the story. So as a writer, as an author, how do you decide what's going to move your story forward, and what do you leave out?
That's a good question, man, and it's really hard. I think propulsion of narrative is really important to me. So, well, I would say, first of all, you know, building characters, and even though this isn't fiction, I view historical characters or figures to be characters as well. So I want the reader to come to know them and come to feel something about them and understand them and their motivations.
You do a great job of that, Bernie. You really do a great job of that.
Oh, thank you very much. And then, so, yeah, I think it's a matter of propelling the story always forward. I try to visualize these stories as if they were taking place on screen, like as a movie. And so I think of the sequences as scenes. And if you were watching it on a big screen, like where would be the natural place to cut and move on? So they're kind of like a series of miniature cliffhangers. I mean, it's sort of what you're trying for, but all the while attending to the history and the you know, the facts that are right. And also, you know, there end up being a lot of moving parts. And so one thing that benefited me in this book is that you've got you know, Stephenson's doing one thing and Bartlett and the members of the Carluck now are doing another thing. And so it allowed me to cut back and forth between what they're doing and what the other party's doing. And so you get some built-in mystery of, like, what's going to happen to them while you're away from them. I hope that answers your question.
It does, it does. I think when you're writing books like this, you're doing all this research and learning about all this history and people's characters and decisions that they made, we take something from it. What's the one thing you took from this expedition experience?
Wow. you know, I mean, we have a story here that involves, you know, terror on the frozen seas, shipwreck, mutiny, heroism, cowardice, frostbite, potential murder, starvation, and a dramatic rescue attempt. And so it's sort of hard to pick one, but I would say that, you know, out of Bartlett's character, I take a kind of selflessness that in the throes of everything that he is contending with, when one has a singular focus to, you know, do the thing that you set out to do, a kind of dedication to your comrades and your fellow man and the people that you are, your family and the people that you are responsible for, to see that to the end.
Yeah, I like that. And without giving away any spoilers here, for those who don't want spoilers, are there any major myths that you can maybe bust here, put a different light on?
Ah, let's see.
That's a big question.
Well,
so,
I mean, I sort of make the case myths that I want to dispel.
And I know you took great effort in writing your book. I heard you say this, that you don't like to put your author imprint on it, so to speak. You don't like to put your own judgments. You like the characters to share. So, you know, if there's a no answer there, that's okay.
Well, no, it's one of those things where there's probably going to be an answer that I come up with after we get off. I'll
kick
myself, so.
No, that's okay.
It's not so much a myth that's dispelled, other than that that people, if you look at someone like Stephenson and then Bartlett, I mean, I pit them in a way as a hero and a villain, but people are always more complicated than they come across as being, probably. And so I think it's, but at the same time, I think what is true is that an episode like being locked in the ice for months and months on end and being, you know, shipwrecked really does bring out who people actually are at their core, you know?
Yeah.
You can't sort of hide who you are, who your real character is.
No, I think that would surface pretty quickly. So while you wrote this book, we were in the middle of the pandemic. You became a grandfather for the first time, and you credit your wonderful family with, you know, supporting you and giving you that work-life balance, satisfaction. What else keeps you balanced? Because there's a lot going on in the world. You know, writing's not easy. I don't think it's easy. What else keeps you balanced? We're all looking
at it. I'm really glad you mentioned that. And I actually, I dedicate the book to my grandson who was born during the pandemic. Yeah, I dedicate this book to my grandson, Luke. I think friends and family have to be at the core. You know, I have another gig as a professor of English at Washington State University, which I've held for 33 years, and I participate in a lot of sports. I'm a competitive tennis player and, you know, an outdoors person, hike and fish and sea kayak and travel. And so I think all of those things, you know, allow me to, when I have to finally lock in and sit my butt down in the desk chair and spend the next, you know, however many six or however many months tethered to the chair and the keyboard, I try to have a pretty full life in addition to, you know, the writing life.
Yeah, it definitely helps. I think you've got to have that that contrast too, from the solitude of being a writer to, you know, some noise and activity around you. Well, I look forward to reading more of your work, as I said at the beginning. And I have to say, I'd let listeners know here, I had the best sound effects when I was reading your book, Betty. I jumped on YouTube and I put a snowstorm on there, a snow blizzard on there.
Oh, so, I'm so glad you did that, because, you know, that's, I guess that's the other one of the things that, that a lot of people don't realize, in unless you've heard ice colliding with other ice, or heard glaciers calving, or heard you know, the sound, and few people have heard this and lived, but, you know, the sounds of ice shattering the ship's wooden hull, you know, and wind at gale force shearing over giant forms and hummocks of ice. It's not always quiet and solitude and peaceful out there, but sometimes it is. And that I try to get in there too, that some of the members of the ship spend a great deal of time off the ship and in contemplation and really taking in the sheer beauty, you know, of an aurora borealis in and a moonlight glinting off the rigging of a ship in rhymed with ice, you know.
Right.
So I think both of those things are true.
Right, right. Well, the book is called Empire of Ice and Stone, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Kaluk. And, of course, you can find out much more about you, Buddy, at your website, buddylevy.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Oh, just that, you know, Arctic books are really fun reads, especially in winter, when you can be an armchair adventurer and wrap up in a warm blanket with warm socks and vicariously see other people freezing.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. Make a nice cup of cocoa and settle down. It really is a page turner. And again, Empire of Ice and Stone is the book we talked about today. So, Buddy Levy, thanks for being with us. Really appreciate your time.
Vicky, thanks so much for having me. It's my great pleasure.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, I'm Carson Kressley. Of all the resources in the world, kindness is the most precious. For more than 140 years, American Humane has been working to protect animals in disasters, on farms, on the silver screen, and in zoos and aquariums, caring for the world's vanishing creatures. You can help too by making humane choices every day. Visit AmericanHumane.org for simple ways to build a more caring and compassionate world for all of us.